he told me that one of his mentors is like, hey, the key to being successful in brokeraging is timing, talent, and territory. And he says, if you have all three, you're going to make a ton of money. If you have two out of three, like, you're going to do well for yourself.
Check out my friends at arikoseg.com. From single family rentals to massive commercial portfolios, Ari Koseg can help lower your taxes and increase your cash flow. They have helped investors across the country take advantage of bonus depreciation and save on more than $180 million in taxes in the last year alone. Get a free proposal and find out how much you could save at arikoseg.com/fort. That's recoseg.com/fort. One of my favorite things to do is raise capital. Always been something I love doing. I love putting together deals. But one thing that is always tough for me is putting together the actual pitch deck, which is really important when you're raising capital. Or whether it's a corporate overview or a track record deck or investor reporting collateral, but putting together any kind of deck for guys like me has always just been tough. And so finding a company that could do it, and not only do it, but blow your mind and make some of the best pitch decks you've ever seen, was really cool. Enter Better Pitch. Better Pitch has taken the lead and is making some of the best pitch books I've ever seen. And if you think that not having a great pitch book is important when either raising capital, showing off your company, showing off your track record, showing off to investors, you're mistaken. I think your pitch book is one of the most important pieces of collateral that you could have. So I highly recommend checking out Better Pitch. They have an incredible team. They will work with you. And if you're a Fort listener and you tell them that, they will work with you on as many revisions as you need until you're 100% satisfied. So go check them out. One of the great joys of my life has been building Fort Capital, something that I have loved for a long time. One of the best parts about it is building it with our incredibly talented team across three offices, Fort Worth, Dallas, and Houston, and our team abroad. We've built an incredible enterprise focused around a mission of being the best real estate operator in the world. We really believe the better that we get at operating, the better that we get in investing. We've built some incredible technology that gives us the ability to see data that others can't, and operate our company as efficiently as possible and deliver better customer service to our tenants and really everybody involved. If you want to know more about our thesis, I encourage you to go to our website, fortcapitallp.com, where we talk about why we've been investing in Class B industrial real estate since 2016, hyper-focused on it. You can learn how you can help us find deals, more about our technology and how we think about it. You can see job openings. Highly encourage you to check out our newsletter or follow us on LinkedIn. And you can do all of this by going to fortcapitallp.com. Omar, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate you taking time.
Chris, I appreciate you reaching out.
I have been so impressed from afar watching you and even studying you this week. I thought was more impressive and where I wanted to start the show is kind of how you grew up and how your family got to Miami. It's the American dream story. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, thank you. So my father was born in Miami, but subsequently moved to Honduras when he was a young teenager, a kid, where he met my mom, who is just from Honduras. And pretty much they decided that they would rather be, you know, call it lower middle class in the United States for my brother and I to have better opportunities in life than to be, you know, the top 1%, 10% of Honduras with the businesses and relationships that we had there. Most of my family is still over there, but basically my parents, when I was 10 years old, decided to just pack their bags and come over with really no plan and no money and no anything. You know, they didn't go to college. And pretty much I grew up with the best teachers life could have ever given me, which is like, hey, if you want something, go for it. And the world will sort of work in your favor. So that's kind of the context of how I got here. And, you know, I basically got into Miami with no connections, no money, no anything, and have done relatively well for myself, fortunately.
What did your parents do when they got to Miami?
Anything. My dad was basically shipping like used car parts and things like that back and forth between here and Honduras. There was like an arbitrage on, hey, I can buy it here for X and I could sell it over there for Y. So at first there were still like connections and business, you know, for him to be able to make ends meet that way. And then my mom started working as an esthetician, like she would do skincare. So, you know, facials and I don't know, massages and things like that. And then now she owns a medical spa that does laser hair removal and things like that. So, you know, started her own business. And that was, as I'm sure many of your listeners have heard, my mom saying, hey, I can do this better than the people that I'm working for are doing it. And my dad was like, all right, go for it. And she opened up Dermalaser in 2008, as you know, the world was apparently falling apart. I was too young to notice. And now Dermalaser is still up and running. And, you know, she's very happy and has made her own life. And now we have investors reaching out trying to expand the business. And my mom's like, no, I'm good making the money I'm making. I'm happy serving my clients. And that's her take. And then my father ended up getting into residential real estate. And something that we'll talk about is basically, you know, that I got my real estate license when I was 18 in high school and would help him. Well, growing up, I would go to tours with him and see him pitch a house and a condo and how it works in Honduras and how I'm realizing works across the country when one wealthy individual buys something in Miami and does very well for himself. He tells his friends and then all those wealthy individuals start wanting to buy something here and don't want to miss the boat. So my father started selling, you know, a lot of houses and condos that started trending up towards the luxury end of the spectrum while I was growing up. And, you know, basically Saturdays was like, come in the car with me or we've got 7 showings. And when I would complain that it's 2 p.m. in the afternoon and I haven't eaten and I'm hungry, he would say, you know, you don't eat while you work. You eat once you're done working. And that type of mentality, you know, served me well. So that was the background for, I guess, me into real estate. And I, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it. But basically, in working and selling some larger luxury homes with my father, I realized that I wanted more intellectual stimulation from like sales. And you know, I when I was in college, I wanted to be like an investment banker and really be doing a lot more analytics than a home sale or a condo sale. Yeah.
Well, they say that Miami is the capital of South and Central America. Your family came up. Was Miami the only place they wanted to go? And is that same dynamic that was probably 30 years ago when they moved here or 20 years ago, is that same dynamic still in play today where it is the place that people from those countries still want to be, whether they're wealthy or whether they're just wanting to come in and build a better life for their family?
I'll answer the second part of the question, which will be shorter, which is, I think now Miami is not the only place Latin Americans want to go to build better opportunities because it's gotten so expensive. You know, if they only speak Spanish, yes, it's probably Miami. But now, you know, there's opportunities in other parts of Florida and Miami has gotten really expensive over the last, you know, 10, 20 years. To answer the original part of your question, yeah, Miami is still, I think, in large part, if you can afford it, the only place you want to go if you are, you know, Latin American. Not that there isn't people in, you know, California, New York and things like that, but I read something that 7 out of 10 people in Miami identify as Hispanic or Latino. And I think one way to put it, which maybe, you know, this will talk a little bit about Miami and where it is in the global spectrum, is just in the past week and a half, I've, you know, had dinners and talked with, you know, very wealthy individuals that are all considering moving to Miami. And I'm not in residential real estate and I could probably make a lot of money selling them expensive homes. But, you know, two nights ago, I had a dinner with the CEO and founder of one of the largest co-living apartment managers in the world. And he, you know, lives, I don't know if he wants this to be public, but lives internationally and is like, hey, I want to move to Miami. And then just yesterday, we're trying to do a deal with one of the richest Turkish families in Turkey. And he said, one of the board members of the family said something very interesting where he said, you know, for the first time in my life, I've had someone ask me whether they should buy a property for wealth preservation in London or in Miami. And he said, you know, I thought they would have said London and New York, right? London and LA, London and another super city. And they said London or Miami. And I think it speaks to the shift that has not only happened, but has continued to happen. Not to go away from sort of my upbringing and how I, you know, got to where I am today.
All right, let's talk about Miami. You're kind of right in the middle of it. I think you made it just a great point. It's a market that the world is starting to see differently. But let's just kind of start with, I understand the last few years, things have been amazing there and we can talk about that. But as you look at the market today, and we're going to pick apart this market in different ways, generally speaking, what's going on in Miami right now?
Generally speaking, what's going on is outside of Miami, the thought, I believe, is that there is way too much oversupply coming into the market and that there's, you know, going to be negative rent growth and a bunch of, you know, negative things that are going to happen, right? I think once you look at the players that are here interested, what's happening is, and this happens in every market, is rent growth, supply and demand is submarket specific. So there's some pockets that are seeing a lot of supply, and those pockets will see flat to probably slightly negative rent growth, but that doesn't mean that those buildings won't get fully leased and won't end up stabilizing. If you look at Miami in total, you know, there's different numbers. Our number is that there's 23,934 units under construction in Miami-Dade County. That's only 7% of existing inventory. It's not that much. And if you break apart that number, those units are under construction over a 2 to 3 year timeframe, right? So annually, it's actually, call it 2% of inventory that actually gets delivered, right? Last year, we saw 7,300 units get delivered. That's, call it 2% of inventory. So I know big numbers get thrown around of how much supply is coming. I think when you actually break it down, there's some submarkets that will struggle short term. I think the macro view or the macro of what's happening in Miami will sort of lift all boats. And the people that may get in trouble, and I think this is around the country, are just the sponsors that, you know, overlevered with floating rate debt and poorly financed an acquisition. If I sold you an asset at a 3 cap in 2000 and, you know, late 2021, early 2022, but you put a 10-year fixed rate loan on it at 2.6%, my bet would be that by 2032, you're going to be all right on that asset, personally. We'll see where the cards lay, but, you know, that's my view.
So a lot of what you're seeing, and I think it's across the country, is sponsor specific. It's more of a, when did you buy and how did you finance it type of recession, rather than everybody just getting crushed.
That's exactly right. A lot of the people that have sold assets over the last 9 to 12 months are people whose funds, the fund life was ending, people who financed it poorly. And, you know, nobody that owns an asset that doesn't have to sell is selling. And I think for good reason. Obviously, cap rates are up. And yeah.
Okay. I'm going to pick three submarkets that from being an out-of-stater, a Texan. Let me just start by saying I love Miami. I've been there probably once or twice a year for the last 4 years, and I love it every single time I go. I'm going to pick three, and if you want to talk about more, we can. Tell me your view of them. Let's start with Brickell. What's going on there is like an act of God. There's just tower after tower and land sites that are selling for hundreds of millions. When I say Brickell, what do you think about?
I think that there is no better place to live in Florida than Brickell. It is the cleaner version of New York. And I don't mean that by office square feet, obviously. But what I mean is that there's somewhere to work. There's somewhere where you can live. There's places to go eat and walk around and have a good time late at night, all within a pretty short, you know, within a pretty small neighborhood. So there's probably, I think, no better living than in Brickell. As you mentioned, there are some big developments going on. The biggest one is probably Stephen Ross, related companies, and Swire looking to lease and break ground on One Brickell City Center. You know, what we're seeing is a lot of office activity. And right now, office leasing brokers are working to the bone to try to convince, you know, these big Fortune 100 companies to make long-term decisions in a tough macroeconomic environment. So I'm not an office leasing broker. I know those conversations are happening. I know they're not easy, just as any long-term decision in this environment's not easy. But yeah, I'm a big bull in Brickell. I think something to mention is it's so expensive to buy land and to build in Brickell today that all the new deliveries, you know, are asking $2,000 a square foot plus, right? The ones that have gotten financed recently were probably asking $1,300 to $1,500 a square foot plus. I bought my condo for $400 a square feet, and now it's probably worth $800 a square feet. So I think on a relative basis, it's going to end up being like the hub of finance in Florida. And things are so expensive that you're not going to see the amount of supply that you're seeing in markets like downtown Miami, Wynwood, and some other pockets.
You posted a site the other day on Twitter. It was 4.5 acre site, Aimco for $650 million. Is that in Brickell?
That is in Brickell. It's, so if you go to our kitchen in Brocadia's office, it's overlooking that those two buildings. And then to the right of our view is Ken Griffin's $363 million acquisition. So it's an interesting location to be officed out of. And I live a block away from those two pockets.
Okay. Yeah. So, but it's not just a site. There's two towers on that site. So the buyer of that site will probably tear those towers down and take it back down to the dirt, or will they keep those towers in play and build around them?
If I had, definitely it's a redevelopment play, right? I don't want to talk about information that I can't share, but I do know that the buyer is seeing this as a long-term land value play. And how I would envision it would work is, hey, the apartment building, that's half of the site, and the office tower, which is the other half of the site, cash flows very well. They're both fully occupied. You know, I think the office building's in the 90s and the apartment complex is like 97, 98% occupied. So my thought is someone's going to buy them, have the carrying costs paid for, and then in the future be able to, you know, do condo sales or raise a lot of money and equity to do a long-term redevelopment play. I think to Aimco's credit, there was a, you know, gentleman there that I'm friendly with that when they were buying those buildings, you know, the apartment building they bought, I think over 10 years ago, and the office building they bought in 2018, if I'm not mistaken, they were saying, hey, this is a, you know, 20-year covered land play, whether for us or for someone else. And I'm like, wow, that is very smart. And then what ended up happening is the office that they bought in 2018, I think, just became so lucrative because of the post-COVID trends in Miami that it made sense to renovate it and keep it as an office for now. But it doesn't hurt them to go and try to find a Ken Griffin or another Ken Griffin-esque buyer to buy, you know, very unique real estate in Miami.
That's just his office site. Isn't he also building like a billion-dollar house in Miami or something like that?
In Palm Beach, yeah, on Ocean Boulevard. He's building a billion-dollar residence. Yeah, and then Jeff Bezos has bought, you know, three houses in the last like 2 years. And just like last week or 2 weeks ago, he bought a third $90 million residences in Billionaire's Bunker in Indian Creek, next to, you know, Carl Icahn and Tom Brady and, you know, some other very wealthy individuals.
All right. I want to take a sidebar for a second because we're 10, 15 minutes in this conversation. You've mentioned, you know, you're friendly with Aimco, you're talking to a Turkish, one of the most wealthy families, and just doing research on you, you've made connections with, call it, the global elite. I want to know, and how old are you? You're 30?
Yeah, I turned 30 a couple months ago.
Okay, so how are these connections being formed? Are these people calling into the market and you just happen to be on the phone? Are you going after them? Like, how are you bridging the gap and building this world-class network?
Yeah, and I mean, in short, I couldn't be doing any of this without my team. What I want to get into, if we can take a quick tangent, is because I think it answers your question, is basically how I just got to this position of where I'm at, right? So my luckiest break, I think, in my life, of which I have many, but my biggest one was when I was a senior in college. My prom date from high school went to Harvard and ended up going to Harvard and was working at a hedge fund in Miami that had just opened up. and she was interning there for a summer. And when she was leaving, she said, hey, you know, I'm sure they could still use the help if you want to go and see if they want to take you in to help them. And when I showed up, there was actually, I thought it was going to be sort of like a shoo-in, like, hey, I'm going to work for free. Why would you say no? When I showed up, there was people there from Stanford and Penn and trying to get that internship. It wasn't just me. And I basically leveled with the, you know, partners there and said, listen, I live here. I'm not looking for this to be a 3-month internship. Like, I will be here for as long as you need me. I'm learning a lot. I will work very hard. And they gave me what I would call a very lucky break to work for them. So they introduced me to the world of like finance and how people actually make money and look at the stock market and things like that. And then after being there for about a year and a half, and you know, we were investing in public stocks around the world, was when I decided to break into real estate, private equity. The reason why I did that was because I realized in seeing them being successful as hedge fund owners, I said, what makes them good at their job are not my strengths, right? My strengths are social skills and I love Miami and that's kind of what I'm interested in doing. So what I ended up doing was reaching out to any and every firm or person that I saw bought a building or did anything in South Florida through news articles like The Real Deal, South Florida Business Journal. And if your name was on there, like Chris Powers at Ford Capital just bought an industrial building for $27 million, you were getting a call from me. And I was basically saying, like, you know, in short, what steps should I take to either work for you in the future, work for you if you have some openings now? And after doing that for about 6 months, I ended up getting an internship at a company called Lloyd Jones Capital. There was, you know, a little, some things in between, but I ended up landing a job at Lloyd Jones Capital, working for free again, right? So I was making, call it $60,000 a year. I didn't think I was going to break into real estate after 6 months. So when I got in front of basically someone like you, on the way out of the interview, when I realized I didn't think I was going to get the role, which they weren't even hiring for, I said, who's sitting in that empty, you know, cubicle over there? And they said, nobody. And I'm like, I will leave my job and go work there for free if you just give me the opportunity. And the CEO loved that, gave me the opportunity. And 2 weeks later, I was working for free again for a real estate private equity shop that bought value-add multifamily apartments across the Southeast United States. And that's how I cut my teeth into things. And when I was there, my realization was that, you know, there wasn't a path, I think, in that shop and other shops to be making $500,000 a year plus, you know, in the private equity world, right? We didn't have these huge name shops down here. So when I started getting in contact with investment sales brokers and growing relationships with them to be able to have them sell us buildings, I started asking them, you know, how much, you know, how's your day-to-day like? You know, what conversations are you having? Who do you get to know? Who do you meet? How much money do you make? And very quickly, I was like, man, I really like the brokerage community within that, you know, selling $50 million plus buildings, right? Like institutional assets. So what I did, and I know it's a long-winded way to answer your question, but I think it's anybody could do this in the country right now. What I did was I mapped out through publications and resources who are the most active brokers in my market. And then I did research that asked the question, or that answered the question, how big are their teams? And I basically mapped, you know, the highest volume brokerage shop with the least amount of people and said they probably need help. So I would reach out to those two companies, and you know, this was 8 years, you know, 7-8 years ago now. I reached out to those two companies, one of them being HFF, if you, you know, obviously remember the name before the JLL acquisition, and Chris Drew, which, you know, still a mentor and friend that I cold reached out to, basically said, we're not hiring. And I said, that's fine. You're going to hire eventually. You're growing a team. What can I do today to make sure that the next person you hire is me? Obviously, you know, he liked that type of response. And he said, you know, you should go to New York and try to take this financial modeling exam with Joshua Carr. So I emailed Joshua Carr and said that here's kind of my story. I don't have any money to really fly to New York and take your $5,000 course. Joshua Carr replied, hey, it's an in-person course and there's always empty seats. If you can just get to New York, I'm happy to just, you know, have you join the class for free. So I flew out there and basically, you know, tried to sell myself into these brokerage shops. The two shops that I sort of went for was HFF and Walker & Dunlop. I ended up getting offers from both and I ended up choosing Walker & Dunlop. Again, just supply and demand. They had only two partners, two senior partners, and their analyst had just taken a job on to the principal side. So I was going to be the only analyst. And I said, great, I'd rather be there than one of 15 analysts at HFF. And what I very quickly realized was Walker & Dunlop was receiving all these opportunities, right, inbounds from the senior partners. And I was the only guy outside of the senior partners. So very quickly, they started giving me a lot of rope to run. And very quickly, they started putting me in front of clients. I think more so because they had to. They're like, hey, I can't make it to this tour. Can you make it to that tour? And I'm like, sure. When I show up to this tour, it's, you know, Michael Safransky that is representing the Kushner family. And I'm like, hi. And at the time, whatever, I'm 25, you know, and you sort of get thrown into the deep end, but you learn very quickly that way. And, you know, I ended up working at Walker & Dunlop for almost 3 years. And then I got recruited to come over to Berkadia. And to answer your question, and, you know, obviously super long-winded way, opportunities that came to my team's plate where I was the next man in line to take the call, have the tour. I would basically show up to these opportunities, you know, extremely prepared. And then that person, whoever it may be, you know, I would follow up with, stay in touch with, and then you sort of extrapolate that over, you know, 50 some deals, all with very reputable players. And when we sell one deal, you know, we have 20, 30 offers from, you know, your Avalon Bays, Blackstones, Harbor Group Internationals. So I'm growing relationships with all of them. And little by little, they're like, wow, this Omar guy is very helpful. And this Omar guy is, you know, super responsive and he's on the ball and he helps me out a lot. So those relationships just grow. And then Twitter is the other side of the coin, which is has brought my brand and industry, I guess, expertise, has made it national and sometimes even global. So it's just been a bunch of inbounds. You know, the only people that I reach out to specifically that I say, hey, I got to get in front of this guy, is if they're actively building something in South Florida and me or my partners don't know who that person is. Then I'm like, okay, well, let's get in front of them.
Omar, it's hard not to root for you. Okay, real quick, on you mentioned Blackstone. Do you have anything to say about their recent acquisition of the Air REIT? I know a lot of those assets were in South Florida.
Yeah, I think two things that I want to say. One is, I don't think anybody really knows the implied cap rate. Yesterday, I was in a meeting with people way smarter than me saying the implied cap rate was 4.6%. And then last night, I was on Twitter seeing some anonymous account that looked very smart saying it was 7.2% or something like that. So I have no idea. I can't speak to that. That's one thing. The other thing that I could speak to is I do feel like Blackstone making such a big bet in the multifamily space is going to spur activity and is going to give institutions a lot more confidence to be buying deals at prices that we haven't seen in, you know, 4 or 5 years in some of these assets. And what we've seen, at least locally, and this I think translates nationally, is typically when there's a big, you know, dip in pricing and some disallocation, the first movers that come in to buy in the market are private capital people that are either wealthy themselves or have, you know, are sponsors of wealthy individuals and families. They're not the institutions, right? The institutions have a lot of IC and red tape that they have to clear. So we've seen over the last 12 months, a lot of these private capital buyers buy deals because their time horizon for these investments could be 7, 10, 15 years as opposed to 3 to 5. So I think with Blackstone obviously being probably the largest institution in the space, I think it's going to allow, you know, their Blackstone's peers to start becoming more active.
Okay, back to where we were a second ago. I'm assuming you're not working for free anymore. You get paid now. There is no more free work for Omar. You've mentioned that you know a lot of the players and how you've gotten to know them. One of the things I think about when I think about Miami are these really dominant developers that are already in the market, the Relateds of the world. How hard is it for an incumbent to get into the market when it seems like there's 3 or 4 that are, you know, kind of dominated, Terra, Related, folks like that? Is there room for more, or do they kind of have a stranglehold on it?
I put a tweet out. We sold an acre of land for $40 million in downtown Miami to the John Buck Companies out of Chicago. Huge. People will be shocked in hearing this, but I had no idea who they were. And they've built $7 billion worth of developments. So they're big players. And that's someone that we helped break into the market. But to answer your question, yes, most of the deals, the land deals and the opportunities that get thrown around in South Florida, you know, Related, Terra, all these guys have like a first look at them. And that doesn't mean that somebody can't come in still, you know, pay probably a higher price or put forward more aggressive terms and not make money, right? A lot of these deals, it's like someone like Related might say, hey, I'm happy to buy this deal for $20 million. And then we go and find an out-of-state player that has been dying to be in Miami and is fine buying it at $22 million. I think all else being equal, we've done a lot of transactions with the local players. So if your terms are the same, if pricing is the same, we will just typically vouch for the group that we know has the capability to close and deliver a great product for the community. But that's not to say you can't break in. There's a lot of groups over the last 24 months that are brand new to South Florida and are, you know, building buildings. I think part of the reason why I've had the success, you know, the relative amount of success that I've had is because, and I learned this from one of my senior partners, Jarrett Turkel, which is also on Twitter. What he told me was, you know, Omar, I've been doing this for 20 years. He said, for the first 10, 15 years of my career, when I saw a bid list of people that were offering on our deals, I knew every single one of them. In 2021 and 2022, I would show up and, you know, put together a bid list of 50 people, like here are the 50 offers and that are interested in this deal. And Jarrett would be like, I don't know any of these. Who are these people? And they were people from Chicago, New York, New Jersey, San Francisco, Canada, Germany. And I'm like, I don't know people that called and are interested in Miami. And he's like, I know 5 out of these 30 people. So for me, being young in the industry and being, you know, the young partner in the team, Jarrett and Roberto are in their mid-40s and I'm 30, it allowed me to, you know, start and grow these relationships with all these new players. So it's very, very fortunate. I had somebody tell me, his name is Kyle Wade. So shout out to Kyle. I'm a big fan. And he's actually in the industrial space and looks up to you a lot, Chris. He told me that one of his mentors is like, hey, the key to being successful in brokeraging is timing, talent, and territory. And he says, if you have all three, you're going to make a ton of money. If you have 2 out of 3, like you're going to do well for yourself. And when he told me that, I thought about it and I said, okay, talent, I hope I have. Timing has been, I mean, I'm in the 1% of landmass in the entire globe that has just risen like insanely fast, right? So timing, I couldn't have gotten a better timing. And then the other one was territory, right? And it's Miami. I remember when I started working as a broker, they said, hey, you're sort of geographically constrained to South Florida and selling multifamily and land in South Florida. And I said, that is more than enough for me, sir. Like, I will happily take that territory. So, you know, I think a lot of success in life is luck. And that doesn't mean that you don't have to work hard. But yeah, I think there's still a lot of developers and new incumbents that are breaking into the space. And, you know, they have to probably underwrite twice as many deals and in some cases, you know, go non-refundable more quickly than they'd like to or pay a little bit of a premium. But if they come with it and looking at it from a long-term orientation, you know, it typically pays off to have a deal in the books down here if you want to grow here and if your investors want to be here.
Are there differences, like really noticeable differences between domestic buyers and foreign buyers?
I will tell you the biggest misconception of foreign buyers, like, you know, non-US buyers. They are very sophisticated and they ask even more questions than the domestic institutions, right? So like the deal that we're trying to do with one of these Turkish billionaire families, they have asked us hundreds of questions. They've flown in from London and Monaco and all these places to look at various sites and sponsors and all these things. So I think the biggest thing to point out is that it's there's no, I don't say there's no, but by and large, if you're talking about institutionally sized assets, the international players that are looking to break in here are extremely sophisticated and do a lot of diligence before making a bet. That doesn't mean that there aren't cowboys that we all know locally, and you know they're the best buyers if you can get their attention. But by and large, there's no unsophisticated buyer that's just going to buy your deal two times more expensive than the next guy, even though a lot of people think they exist.
Okay. What's your activity been like this year? Are things actually trading in the market this year, or is it kind of like the rest of the country? It's just pretty down, if not flat, from 2023?
Yeah, I start every meeting with a client or prospect this year by saying, you know, I'm busy working, but not busy closing. So, I mean, to give you a sense of the activity that we had in 2021 and 2022, or I'll just tell you about the market in general. So, South Florida, between Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County, saw about $3 to $4 billion of transactions in the multifamily space. This is including deals that are priced above $5 million. So $3 to $4 billion of transaction activity annually. In 2021, that transaction activity went up close to $15 billion. Right, so we're talking almost a 4-5x in activity. If you could imagine, our activity in 2021 went up, you know, 4-5x. Then in 2022, it went down to $8 billion, which was still 2 to 3 times what we were originally used to historically. In 2023, which is obviously the last calendar year I can speak to, there was $3.2 billion worth of sales. And in 2019, there was like $3.1 billion worth of sales. So we're back to the historical average, if you will. I think that'll creep up as obviously the markets open up a little bit. But it feels slower than it's ever felt ever because our, you know, frame of reference is a month where we closed 5 $100 million deals, right? In 2021. I'll never forget. It's crazy, but this goes back to timing. There was a month, I'll never forget, October 30th of 2021, we closed a $132.5 billion three-property portfolio in October. It was a Friday in October, right? $132 million. Monday, we closed an $108 million deal, you know, the next business day. And then Thursday of that week, we closed an $133 million deal with AvalonBay later that week. So I'm like, dude, within a week, we just did 3 9-figure deals. And then the next month, we closed a $355 million portfolio to Grant Cardone that we sold. And then that same week, we closed an $110 million deal in Sunny Isles. So wherever we are today definitely feels a hell of a lot slower than where we were, you know, 24 months ago. But to answer your question more specifically, yeah, this year we've done about $2.9 billion worth of proposals, like listing proposals. About 75% of that is multifamily listings. 25% of that is land listings. I would say 80, 90% of those proposals turn into the client owner saying, hey, I'm not a seller at these numbers. And we say, yeah, we agree that you shouldn't be if you don't have to. And then the other 10%, you know, call it, we have probably like a 25% chance of winning listings relative to our, you know, the other competitors in the market. So this deal, we've closed an acre of land for $20 million, overlooking actually Billionaire's Bunker, where Jeff Bezos and all these guys live and have bought deals. And we closed a $24 million townhome deal in Fort Lauderdale. Outside of that, we've marketed about $200 million worth of properties. And, you know, unfortunately, all of those have gone away from us with a, you know, 3 to 7% delta on pricing, where the seller's just saying, hey, I'm not a seller under, I'm going to make up a number to not speak about any deal specifically, but the seller says, I'm not a seller under 89 million. And we've got offers at 85 million, 6 million. And it's just like, hey, we get it. It is what it is. So it's definitely a tough market, but I think it's a huge opportunity right now for everyone, like yourself included, Chris, to be doubling down on, you know, marketing, branding, meetings, clients, so that when the market does open up, you're that much more prepared to take advantage of the next cycle, which is the reason why, you know, you see me on this podcast. I've started a podcast to chat with clients, and it's basically like, all right, I'm not busy cold calling and closing deals, so let me continue branding and marketing myself and having FaceTime with clients. And I think in life, you just have to understand where you are in the market and what's the best thing and way for you to add value to yourself and your you know, your people in the future. And right now, that's I think marketing for us and my team and the brokerage community.
Are you seeing a wave of activity of, you said that the bid ask is off. You guys have put forth a lot of proposals. Is there light at the end of the tunnel where you see activity where people are saying, look, we do want to start moving product from the sales side? Or is that still just kind of flat right now because nobody needs to sell?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't need to sell, you're probably still not selling today. What I would say is, and this is probably the best way to answer your question, 12 months ago, when we would put valuations in front of clients, right, we would call them first and be like, hey, are you sure you want us to like physically turn this into you? Let us tell you where the pricing came in at. And when they saw the price, you know, they would fall off their chairs and say, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You know, there's no way it's worth this. That was 12, 18 months ago. Today, we submit valuations at where we think we can transact on these deals. And they're like, yeah, I kind of figured it was around that price point. Which makes me believe that the bid ask spread and the expectations are narrowing. I think Jerome Powell, you know, the Fed sort of confirming that they're still looking for rate hikes into the end of this year has given sellers, you know, some hope that there's a reason why they should hold out for those rate hikes to come. And then, you know, buyers is interesting. People talk about, hey, there's a lot of money that's been raised to buy deals, to buy distress, but I can run around and go raise $500 million saying that I want to find you 25% levered returns on existing multifamily assets. Like, I'm not going to find those types of deals, right? Right now, deals are trading between a 12 to 15% levered return. So you can raise all the money in the world, but if the expectation is off from where deals are transacting, you're not going to deploy it, right? Like, is it really dry powder?
You said rate hikes. You mean rate cuts? Sellers are waiting
rate for... cuts.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to talk about insurance for a second. One of the biggest words surrounding South Florida in general is insurance. And so maybe just the question is, how are people dealing with insurance? Have you seen any creative ways? I'm assuming the much bigger companies have advantages that the smaller companies don't have. But when I say insurance to you, what do you say?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. So I think it's a huge opportunity for institutions and more larger, more sophisticated players that have like portfolio and umbrella policies to buy deals in South Florida where the private buyer who's got an insurance quote of $2,500 per unit per year, you have it at $1,700 per unit per year across your master policy, right? So I think it's an opportunity for the bigger players to buy deals at a comparatively better price for them. That's one thing. Creative things that I've heard and seen are two. One is, you know, Florida has flood zone maps with FEMA. And there's a very large shop that has been very successful in making the case that these flood zone maps were done 50 plus years ago and are extremely outdated relative to like the elevation and how this specific deal was built. And if they're able to change the flood zone rating of the area in which their asset is from, you know, X to A, the insurance will be much lighter than what it was previously. So some of the, my larger clients have had creative success in talking with like flood zone FEMA experts to change how that piece of land is designated to insurers. That's one interesting thing I've seen. The other one is just lowering, you know, insurance requirements for assets that they've bought historically, whether self-insuring it or saying, hey, you know, to get Fannie and Freddie, we need this much insurance. We don't need that much insurance. So let's insure just as much as the lenders require. But from a macro perspective, I've started to hear this year that we aren't receiving, my clients aren't receiving, you know, 30, 40% hikes in insurance, and it's leveling off to, you know, 3 to 5%, which is still high. Obviously, you know, you can't say that in the vacuum because everybody's deal and portfolio is different, but it looks like it's starting to stabilize. It's a huge question. It's a huge issue. And I think it's going to create opportunities, right? Like when there's dislocation in the market, there are more opportunities. So I think it's an interesting thing to be on top of. And if you are fortunate as a buyer to have a relative advantage in the insurance world, I think there's ways to capitalize on that in Florida.
Okay. What about the condo crisis? You've talked quite a bit about it.
Ooh.
What's going on there?
The condo crisis in Florida, and I think in South Florida specifically, I think is the biggest macroeconomic trend, secular trend that's happening in South Florida. It is a huge problem. And to try to give everyone the context so they can quickly understand what's going on is in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s, people were building, you know, very small condos, right? 8-story, 12-story, 15-story condos using surface parking lots, not garage parking, on the ocean. So what ends up happening is now we've got condos that are on 3 acres of land on the ocean that have 50 units. And those units people are buying for $300,000 to $400,000 because it's a 60-year-old building that's, you know, not looking so hot, right? And basically now developers are coming in and saying, hey, those 3 acres of land are worth, you know, let's say $100 million, just to keep the math simple. There's 50 units in this building. These 50 units are selling for $500,000 each. So the units individually total $25 million, but the land is worth $100 million. So let's offer these unit owners, you know, $30, $40, $50, $60 million and tap into that land that's under it. What's been happening over the last 50 years in South Florida is these condo boards have delayed and deferred capital expenditures in their buildings. Obviously, to cash flow the asset, the building better, if you can pay $1,000 a month in HOA fees or $500 a month in HOA fees, a lot of people are not going to understand, you know, are just going to say, give me the $500 a month. So that over 50 years, it turns out that there's a bunch of deferred maintenance on these buildings, and some buildings are being hit with $2, $3, $4, $5 million capital expenditures, whether it's, you know, plumbing issues, structural repairs, concrete restorations, roofs that need to get replaced. And what's happening is unit owners are being met with special assessments that are $50,000, $100,000, $150,000. And a lot of these people, because I've now met them and talked to them and have now done a condo termination deal, they're not wealthy, even though they're living in great pockets of South Florida. They bought this unit, or their father bought this unit in the 60s for 50 grand or 80 grand. And there's no way that they can afford a $200,000 assessment. But if I or a developer calls them and says, hey, we'll give you $1.2 million for your unit that you would sell on the market for 400 grand, they listen. So what's happening is South Florida is land constrained, right? And this isn't a knock on Texas. I'm a big bull and believer in Texas. I love it.
We love you too.
The reason why I point out Texas is because when people were looking at population migration, like inflows, Florida and Texas were neck and neck. I think Texas was always a little bit ahead. But I think in 2021, Texas saw 470,000 new net migrants and Florida saw 420,000, right? So very comparable. The difference is Texas has 286,000 square miles of land. Florida has 65,000 square miles of land. If you look at South Florida specifically, you only have a 13-mile stretch from the Everglades to the ocean. And a lot of that, what I mentioned, is the Everglades. So there's very, very limited land. Those are 2 points, land mass and population migration. The third point is wealth migration. So obviously, Texas was also a huge beneficiary of wealthy individuals moving into the state. In 2021, the net adjusted gross income of taxpayer money that moved into Texas was $6.3 billion of net adjusted gross income in taxpayer money. $6.3 billion. Florida had $21 billion of net adjusted gross income moving into Florida. Obviously, New York lost $20 billion and California lost $19 billion. Those trends have obviously slowed down, but they're still moving forward. The reason why I mentioned that is because a lot of wealthy people are coming to South Florida. Developers are running out of land to build on. And the land that's available, to your point, is now worth $100 million an acre sometimes. But there's all these condo buildings that were built 50, 60 years ago up and down the coast that they can tap into. And if you're a unit owner in these condo buildings for the last 20 years, if anybody ever approached you, you said, no, beat it. I don't want to sell. I want to live here forever. Well, now those unit owners are being met with $200,000 special assessments. So do you want to pay $200,000 or do you want a $1.5 million check for your unit? A lot of people start listening. So actually what I'm busiest with right now is a flurry, an absolute flurry of condo unit owners calling me, whether through Twitter or Instagram, cold calls and cold emails saying, my building's falling apart. Our HOA is fighting. We have no reserves. Can you help us sell our land? And what I need to do is A, focus on the opportunities that are most likely to transact. And the way I do that is by saying, okay, I think your land is worth X. So if your land is worth X, I think the average unit is going to receive a, let's say, $2 million check, make up a number, right? What do these units individually sell for? If these units sell for $500,000 and I think I can get them a, let's say, $1 million check, I'm going to be able to convince a lot of these people to want to sell their building. If these units are selling for $1 million and I think the land is going to translate to them getting paid $1.2 million, there's not that much of a spread and I'm not going to go and do a year's worth of work with my whole team to try to uncover that land value.
What do you do with the holdouts?
So the first thing you have to do is look at the condo docs. Every building is different. So we've obviously formed really good relationships with the condo lawyers in South Florida. And we tell them about the building. They look at the condo docs. And some condo docs say, hey, you need a 75% majority. Some say 85% majority. Some say 95% majority. If you're me and if you're a developer, you want to focus on the 75% majority condos. There was a situation recently that I don't want to give, you know, too much details just for the client's sake, but you know, it's online, everything's online, so it's nothing confidential, but they didn't have the 95% majority. So what they did was they got a majority of, call it 60%, that they needed to amend the condo docs to lower the 95% number, right? So they said, hey, if we get to 60% of the building, we have a majority to amend the condo docs to make it a lower threshold to be able to tear down the building. And when all that came to light and, you know, those condo unit owners were like fighting and suing them and you know, making a big deal out of it, as they should, the court ended up ruling in their favor and said, hey, you can't do this, right? Like that's not ethical, I guess. And they said, no, you still need 95% to tear down this building. And it's a huge issue because, you know, if you're this developer, you've now spent a bunch of legal dollars, a bunch of marketing dollars, a bunch of time into trying to buy this building. So there are holdouts. There are different ways to work with them. I think at the end of the day, if you're looking to foot a big bill, you're going to, you know, listen more and more to somebody that's trying to give you a check, a big check for your building. But every case is very unique. And I'll give you an example. I have people in my team that are telling me, Omar, you're going to end up just doing a bunch of wild goose chases on 90% of these, and you're going to waste a lot of time. Like, let's go back to selling multifamily. And again, right now the market is slow. And I think this is a huge, you know, secular trend that I want to be in front, well, that I am in front of. But yeah, every case is unique, definitely.
If you were to say, there's something I can spot in the first 30 days that I know I would be wasting my time. Is it the 95%? Everybody has to agree, 95% of people, that probably makes the deal not worth it. Obviously, the spread of what it's worth today versus what a developer is going to pay, that might not make it worth it. Is there anything else that comes to mind when you look at one of these that immediately you could say, yeah, this is probably worth working on?
Well, definitely if the building's too new and isn't going to have these big structural repairs and CapEx issues. But outside of the spread between what these units are worth and what I think I could get them, the other thing is like, hey, what are recently built new construction condos in this pocket selling for? If you call me about a deal in Boynton Beach, right, which maybe you've never heard of, there's probably no condo units that have sold there for north of $1,500 a foot. So the land value isn't going to be as pricey. If you send me a condo redevelopment opportunity next to the Aman and next to the One Hotel in Miami Beach, you know, the Aman sold units for $5,000 a square foot. And those units were averaging 5,000 average square feet. So there were $25 million condo units and they're 100% sold out. Clearly there's probably a lot of land value in those units.
Who buys those? Are those all international buyers or are those big US corporate guys?
It's a great question. So the latest thing I heard from one of the biggest condo sales brokers, like individual condo development brokers, they said that 20% of the condo sales are domestic. A lot of them are from New York. 20% are actually Mexican, from Mexico. 10 to 15% are like LATAM in general. And then the remaining is international. Right now, specifically, and this is like a very new trend, is we're seeing a huge, huge, huge influx of Turkish capital and Turkish migrants. And again, with this Turkish family that we're speaking to, the gentleman said, I took the direct flight from Turkey to Miami, you know, last week, and I knew 75% of the plane. And they were all other families and family offices and investors that I know, and you know, and they're all talking about like, oh, I'm going down to Miami to go look at something. And they're like, yeah, me too, you know? So I think that's the big macro trend of Miami. I have clients that now look to buy in Orlando and Jacksonville and Tampa and St. Pete, because over there you can buy a deal with neutral or positive leverage day one. In Miami, there's still enough demand that deals are trading, you know, 50 to 75 basis points negative leverage, right? So if your debt's at a 6%, the deal's trading at a 5.25. When your debt's at 5.75, the deal's trading at a 5. Obviously, a lot of people don't want to make those bets because the cash on cash returns aren't there for them, but there's enough demand and there's people with a longer term time horizon that they're still buying those types of deals.
Okay, a buddy of mine sent me this question. I think it's a good one. If you had $20 million to invest in Miami, where would you invest it? And if you had $200 million to invest in Miami, where would you invest it?
So $20 million, I would absolutely go buy land. I've sold a lot of land and a lot of multifamily properties, and the ones that make the most amount of money, like equity multiple, are people that buy land. I think the smartest game to play in a place like Miami where land values are skyrocketing is doing land entitlement plays or doing covered land plays. Like you buy a strip mall or an office building that in the future is going to be a condo building or a multifamily building. You don't need to be the developer. You don't need to be related. you can go and get that land and title it and go sell it to Mill Creek, Trammell Crow related, or any of these guys. So $20 million, I would absolutely be buying land. $200 million, I think the best opportunity in South Florida right now from, you know, from the multifamily perspective is buying brand new construction core deals. They are trading 30% below replacement cost and are a screaming good opportunity that institutions are not jumping on because they're trading at a 5 cap when the debt's at a 575 and they're saying it's not meeting our cash on cash return. It's not meeting our 12% levered returns. But I think if you're buying a brand new asset in a primary neighborhood in South Florida for $300 a door, when they used to be selling at $500 a door, you're going to be very happy that you made that acquisition.
Okay, we're going to bring it back to where I started. I want to hit two more markets. Wynwood. What's going on in Wynwood?
Oh, man. So I would say that the amount of supply that's coming into Wynwood is scary to me. And don't make this a highlight in your podcast reel when you send like 30-second blurbs. Make this like the nugget that somebody finds 2 hours into this conversation. Wynwood's seeing a ton of supply. And it's all going to get absorbed. It's all going to get stabilized. The question is at what price, right? At what rental rates? What I've seen in Miami, I've been living here for 20 years, is you might struggle to lease units at, you know, let's say $2,500 a month, $2,500 a month. But if you lower that rent to $2,200 a month, your leasing velocity goes from 15 to 30, right? Overnight. It's a very liquid market. A lot of people are moving in here and obviously there's a lot of turnover in existing buildings. So it will get stabilized, but there is a huge amount of supply coming into Wynwood. And a lot of the owners there are institutional, and I think they're going to weather the storm. Whether it means that they have to give out 2 months of concessions to lease up their units, they're going to do it. And it's going to stabilize. And once it's stabilized and the concessions are out of the rent roll, they're going to look to refi or sell it. But I'm a fan of Wynwood. A lot of walkability, a lot of retail, a lot of stores, some office buildings, but there's definitely those. That's one of the markets where short term, there's a lot of supply coming in.
Is Design District different than Wynwood?
Design District, they're about 10 blocks away from each other. They're definitely different markets. Design District is not seeing a ton of supply. They've been, you know, all the things in Design District are retail and office. There's maybe like two projects, and they're condo projects, not apartment projects. So not many thoughts on Design District outside of the fact that, you know, foot traffic's up almost 2x in the last like 3 years. And it's a place that a lot of people obviously visit, but it's not a big multifamily market.
Okay. Couple more. You've had the opportunity because of where you've been. I love what you said. I think the clip will just be, you talked about the 30 cents clip. I think it's the timing, talent, and territory. I think that's super important.
Ooh, Kyle's going to love that.
Kyle's going to love it.
He Shout texted out to me Kyle last Wayne. Night, like, yes, there you go. It was so true.
Because you've nailed those three, I think it's just really, I keep going back to this. If there was something I envied you on, was the network that you've been able to build. One, because you're incredibly talented, you're likable, you're very good at what you do. But two, because the audience is there. If I were to stick you in Alpine, Texas, it would never happen. You wouldn't meet related 100%. Guys. If I just said, what are the things, like if I said, what's this, your smartest clients? You don't have to say who they are. What characteristics do they have that separate themselves from the pack? Like, why are they so great from how you deal with them as an intermediary?
They are foaming at the mouth for their next deal 24/7. And even I can speak to being relatively less, I wouldn't go work for free again today, right? At 21, 22, I would.
I have a job for you right now for free. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. I'm like, all right, guys, I'm packing my bags. So I meet them and they're at the top of their game. They've done tens of deals. Right now, they're doing tens of deals. And if I call them, if I text them, if I email them with a potential opportunity, they would say, when can I go see it? And it's, I'll text them at 11 o'clock at night. And it's not surprising if they like it that they'll be there at 11 a.m. the next morning. And you could imagine these are very busy people and they make the time for deals. They set everything aside to understand and be on top of the next deal. So I think if you think of someone like Elon Musk or Michael Jordan, you can hear when people talk about them that they're maybe tough to work for because they're just on 24/7, that it's like relentless and it's overwhelming. But if you do that over 40, 50 years, you're going to be at the top of your game. And, you know, for me as a broker, I see that and I'm like, wow, I commend that and I respect that. And I think in the brokeraging world, just a slight tangent, I think it allows you to capitalize on that grit more so than on the principal side and other parts of the real estate industry. Because I'll give you a perfect example. I was in that event last night and the event that I went to, they sent emails out like, hey, looking forward to seeing all you guys tomorrow. And that email had 50 people on it. And I went one by one before the event, searching up who the hell these people were to see which one of them owns or traffics in land or multifamily opportunities. So I set 45 minutes aside of my time to look up all these people. And then when I show up to this event, 99% of those people are like, hi, how are you? Like, what do you do? Hi. And I walk in there and I'm like, there's Chris Bowers, there's Moses Kagan, there's, you know, Don Tetman. And I go right for them and I'm like, hi, how are you? Yeah, no, you're involved in this deal over there, right? And they're like, yeah, I am. And I'm like, oh, we sold the deal across the street. Oh, amazing. And that turns into a coffee, turns into a lunch, that turns into a dinner, that turns into a deal 9 months from now. And if you do that for 30 years, you know, you become the top of your game.
All right, let's bring it home on this then, top of the game. And you've already kind of highlighted this throughout the conversation. People are sitting there right now, market's slow, no matter where you are. You're in the hottest market in the world and it's slow. And you said, I'm spending a lot of my time building my brand, but you were actually doing that even when the market was hot. And so the question is, what has building a brand online done for you? And why did you choose to do it?
I feel like we can talk 30 minutes about this. It's the single most important thing that I think when I look back in my life, I'm going to have looked at, like the single most important thing that I invested in. And it started, I fell upon it through Twitter. Twitter was a more casual medium for me to discuss live opportunities and live deals and market commentary. And when Miami came to the spotlight, a lot of my tweets, you know, were getting picked up by Mayor Francis Suarez and Keith Raboy, which is a big tech investor. And quite frankly, now I am inundated with opportunities, whether in brokeraging or outside of brokeraging, that are very exciting. And for me specifically, I'm being very, and I got to credit Strip Mall Guy for this, you know, by talking to him and other players and, you know, just focus on your craft, focus on multifamily, focus in South Florida, focus on land. Don't get distracted by all the shiny objects that people reach out to you with. But I think the brand is obviously very, very beneficial. And to bring it more to the audience, I guess I would say that you can be a very, very impressive person, but if nobody knows who you are and what you're doing, I don't leave it to chance for someone that owns multifamily or land to stumble upon a deal that I closed. And by yelling on a microphone and repeating, I sell land, I sell multifamily in South Florida for hopefully the highest price possible that the market can bear, people are calling me. And whether you are a plumber or an electrician or a chef, if you continue to brand yourself and sharing that identity with folks, the exponential amount of opportunities that will open up for you are mind-boggling. It's wild to me, the people that I've been fortunate enough to break bread with because of the social media platform. So it's something that I definitely recommend everyone not everyone, but if you want to grow in that direction, for you to invest some time in. And I think, Chris, you're obviously a wonderful example where you're sitting across the table from, you know, Barry Sternlicht and other players like that because of Twitter. And obviously you've had to work at that, but had you just not logged into Twitter, not logged into anything, just put your head down and call the next industrial owner, high likelihood is you wouldn't be in front of Barry. And whatever opportunities come from that aren't, you know, wouldn't have been open to you. I think the best analogy that I received very early on in my life is that life happens serendipitously. And by being this lighthouse in a dark sea of information that says, this is what I do. If you like it, come towards me. The surface area of luck that you're maximizing is going to translate into opportunities. I have calls today that a guy I met at a gym whose friend, whose brother is connected, I just found out recently, to the co-GP equity in a development that I've been trying to get in front of. And I'm like, wait, you're the money behind this deal? And the only reason why is because he saw an Instagram reel of mine. He clicked on my profile. It said that one of his friends follows me. So he reached out to that friend and said, do you know Omar? And that guy said, yeah, I used to work out with him at 5 a.m. like 7 years ago. And now I'm talking to the guy that was the money behind a developer who I'm trying to get in front of. And that'll just multiply if you have an online presence.
Omar, you're the man. Thank you for joining me today. This is awesome.
Chris, I can't thank you enough for reaching out. You know, I think I said it at the beginning. I've caught a lucky wave and somehow it's still going. And I'm very happy that the wave is continuing. So, you know, I think territory, timing, and talent, if you can get those three, you're well on your way.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Fort Podcast. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform or hop on over to YouTube to watch full video episodes if that's what you prefer. For more information, you can check out thefortpod.com.